Welcome to the Emotional Horsemanship Podcast. I am your host, Lockie Phillips, and I help deeply caring equestrians create emotionally balanced horses with science, empathy, and feel. This podcast is a safe place for anyone who desires a better future for horses and for the equestrian lifestyle. I hope that you will enjoy these solo and collaborative episodes where we enjoy a deep insight into our horses' worlds and ways in which we can make that better for them. If you love horses and are willing to do right by them, you're going to love this podcast. And I thank you for being here. Today, my guest is Lynley Bolt. Lynley Bolt is a horsewoman from New Zealand who has lived a life with horses that some of us can only begin to imagine or dream about or watch in movies or read about in books. This has been Lynley's life, a life with horses from the very beginning up until now, and to see, witness, and feel not just her expertise as a horse trainer, breeder, livestock operator on a large station on the North Island of New Zealand, but also her childlike joy for the horse has remained intact throughout a lifetime with them. Rare it is to find horse people who are of her level, her experience, and her expertise who have not become jaded and who have preserved a love for the horse from beginning through till now. It is my pleasure to present her here on the podcast, and I hope you love her as much as I do. Hello, Lynley. How are you?
I'm good, Lockie. How are you?
I'm good. So you said it's 2:30 in the morning for you right now.
Yeah,
and you're still semi-conscious and willing to have a conversation with me.
I'm wide awake.
Are you a night owl or a morning person or an evening person?
I'm a morning, early morning.
Well, this could technically be categorized as early morning, yeah. But I would call this middle of the night or the end of my day because I'm a night person.
Day. Yeah.
So, Lynley, for those who don't know who you are, who are you? Tell us, who are you?
I'm a Kiwi. Mm-hmm. And I am me. I'm not trying to be anybody else. I'm just trying to be me, being with horses as I am. I'm doing something that I never thought I'd ever do because I was so shy. I never spoke. I went to a clinic that, like, I think it was my first clinic, and I said the only two words I said over the 3 days was, Lynley, Laurel. I mean, Laurel being my horse. There was no other word spoken. And that was pretty normal in my life. And now I'm teaching, I'm coaching, and you can't shut me up. And it's the horse has brought my voice. The horse has brought my voice.
That just gave me chills to hear that. So you've been a shy person all your life.
Yep.
Until... how long ago? When did the shift begin?
Oh, would have really started, I don't know, 15 years ago, probably. Yeah. That I really started to actually, or 10 that I really started to talk to the rest of the world. But before that, only people that were close.
Why? Why did you start sharing yourself more with others?
It just sort of came about. People saw me at a clinic and asked me to come and teach them. I was teaching people, friends, coaching them, but not going out. You know, that was a dream to actually go out. That I never believed would happen because I'd have to talk to them. And but I do what I do because of the horse, so I can give back to the horse because of what the horse gave to me, which was life. Yeah, they kept me alive. They stopped suicide plenty. And so I'm giving back what they gave to me. So that's the only reason that I'm actually able to talk to people.
I see amazing, amazing things coming for you. And I'm so not alone. Those who know you and those who've had the opportunity to hear you talk about your work and how you serve horses and serve people, all of us who are close to you are saying, oh my God, Lindley is just on the verge of completely blowing up in the best possible way. And I've had a couple of like positive blow-ups in my life over the last 2 years, and it's a terrifying process, but it's also wonderful. It's this feeling of like, oh my God, I've been paying my dues all these years in a struggle, and now my ship is coming in. Does that ring true for you? Feel familiar to you?
Yeah, it does. It does. Okay. And there's a lot of overwhelm because of it. It's like, you know, taking on a completely new thing, like building a website and doing all the technical stuff behind that. I mean, that actually is the hard stuff. Mm. Being with horses is the easy stuff. Being even with people is the easiest.
Oh my God, yes. Oh my God, yes. So I'm just going to add some context here for anyone listening. So I first ran into Lindley Bolt in summer 2022, so middle of 2022, during a course run by a business mentorship service, which was called Break Free from Burnout. And there was a collection of like-minded equestrian professionals there who had struggled habitually with burnout. And it was this, I think, 9-week or 12-week program about how long was it?
I think it was probably about 9 weeks, but we actually had we had another couple come in. So I think, so it would have been close to 11 or 12.
There would have been like a break in the middle or something like this. But it was kind of an amazing program. And since then, you and I have now entered into this long-term partnership with Christiane Witt and Horse Biz Success, who she was on the podcast as well. Christiane Witt has been my business mentor since 2019, and I'd be dead in the water without her assistance and her mentorship, because just like what you said, we know how to work with horses, and to a certain extent, we know how to deliver services to people, but we don't know how to run businesses. My first equestrian business was an absolute nightmare behind the scenes. I had to close it. It was such a nightmare. So that's how we met. We met talking business, and then I'm going to speak about you to you, if that's all right. Your humility, your thoughtfulness, your dedication, self-discipline, and horse sense shines through in everything you say and you do. And you deserve everything good that's coming for you and more, in my opinion. And I really want people to understand your work. So we've kind of started talking about who you are, but what do you do with your identity?
What do I do? So that's a really hard question. What do I do?
Well, feel free to ramble, Lindley, because I've also got this wonderful little recording studio that allows me to edit out awkward silences. So take as many awkward silences as you need to just start rambling and tell us in explicit detail. You can take the next hour to just describe what you do, because it's probably one of those subjects that I could allow you to speak for 3 hours uninterrupted about it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So go ahead. Start rambling.
So, relationship building. Basically, I'm a relationship coach. And that's the base of it. Building oneness, building unity, building flow, bringing people together and with their horses, building new friends, and I want people to have, even if they're as tiniest little bit as happy as I am when I'm with my horses, oh my God, that's what I want. I want them to be able to be that happy, or even just a smidgen. If they got that, they're free. It's freedom. It's absolute peace. And well, if it wasn't for the horse, I mean, Jesus, we're so unique when we are with a horse. We are more than anything. Like, we can fly. They can bring so much joy and happiness to us. It's and we to them. I think we to them. When your horse wants to be with you more than it wants to be with other people, other horses, that's a cool feeling.
That with your horses?
Not all of them yet. You know, I brought in some rogues, some throwouts, and when those horses turn the corner, wow, that's exciting. You know, these horses are often broken down, and then when they feel good, because I do a lot of in hand work, like classical in hand work, and I join that into life. It's like vaquero work, which to me, and dressage, that is, I was a shepherd. So therefore, everything I do with a horse is what I've done when I'm mustering, when I'm working stock, working my team of dogs. It's all in one. We're doing everything together as a team. I can tell you hundreds of stories of oneness of a team with them. That's where I'm comfortable, out there with
them.
Yeah. And it's heaven.
You were a shepherd. Let's bookmark that, because I need to hear more about your shepherding days. But you bring together, you just said that you bring together classical in handwork, academic classical in handwork, with vaquero horsemanship with dressage.
Yeah.
That's kind of a game changer. Not kind of, it is. That's a game changer. If you're blending those three modalities together in one thing which is seamless, not only are people going to run, not walk, to your services, but I really want to see what that looks like myself. Like, sign me up. Like, where do I sign up for that? That's kind of beautiful. You know. Very good. Very good. So that's amazing. That's amazing. And so you said that you were a shepherd. I think that's really interesting, because there's a lot of congruency there between stock work, good quality, quiet stock work, and the oneness we can experience with horses. They are the same thing, essentially. Yes. Talk to us a little bit about your shepherding background and your shepherding days.
Okay, so I first had a dog when I was, my very first working dog was when I was 4. And my father would get me up like at 3 a.m. Hello, 3 a.m. to go mustering before I caught the bus to go to school, right from tiny. And so we'd be out on our horses, catching our horses in the dark. And I would have been doing that when I was 6 or 7. Feet on the floor, and, you know, he'd just come in and feet on the floor and off we'd go. And that was the start. I've done a little bit of dog trialing, and that's working sheep up a hill or bringing them down a hill. But it's like taking the sheep to the woolshed is the main thing, to do it however you do it, and having that team. We're on steep country where we were really steep and hard, so the dogs were clever, really clever. And there's training in there that is no training. You know, your dog learns on the job a lot of the time in that sort of country. You can put the basics in the small pen, like with schooling a horse, starting a horse under saddle. It's the same deal. Putting them the basic, the groundwork, the foundational work, and going out on hard country and being a team. And there's, you know, often there's no words, no commands, no direction, because we're just, you are one. Now, I remember one time, this is probably the first time though I actually was aware of the intent, the power of intent with my dog. I mean, I had, you know, often I couldn't find my dog and one dog who would never leave your side. You know, she'd never bugger off and do something she shouldn't be doing. And I'd planned my day of how I was going to muster for docking the lambs, and I had to ride along the road 6 Ks to get to the paddock, and I'd had my dog in my head probably 10 minutes before where that dog was going to be. And when I got to the place to put her through the fence to get there, she wasn't with me. Mm. And I called and whistled for her and nobody. And then she did a bark and she was up exactly where I had thought I was going to put her. And she had to go through the neighbours to get there.
Wow.
So how
what breeds of dog was this? What breed of
this
dog?
This was a Hunterway.
I don't even know what that breed is.
So it's a New Zealand big woofing dog, you know, big noise, lots of noise, and very handy.
Mm.
Well, they lots of noise when you ask them for lots of noise. Not they don't just bark
incessantly, like a Pomeranian or something.
No, no.
These are sensible Kiwi country dogs. Damn it.
Yeah.
Yes. Amazing. So this dog, you believe this dog was able to understand your unspoken intention of a very hyper-specific geographical location at least 6 kilometres away, and your dog went straight there without instruction?
Well, she wouldn't have done it 6 Ks away, but she would have done it at least a K before we got to the place because she couldn't get through the fence just because of the way it was. She couldn't have got through there until then because it was – a narrow road, bush each side, and it was like you went through a gateway on the road that didn't have a gate actually closing it, but it was years ago they used to have gates there. And she couldn't have gone through any of that area to get there, so she had to go through the neighbours to get there.
Mm.
Lindley, it was pretty amazing.
How many people do you know that are like you? That's a weird question. I don't even know why I'm asking it. But you've grown up with horses and dogs and sheep and mustering in the country. This is your life. This isn't something you've wandered into. It's something you were born into. It's in your DNA. How many people do you know who are like you? Because it's almost like a dying art, a dying breed. This and also this lifestyle that you're speaking of, how many people are still living this kind of life, at least in New Zealand?
There are a few, but it's really hard because for young people to come in, you know, they're not wanting to. It's, you know, it can be long hours because you get up early. You want to work the stock before the heat of the day. You want to make sure it's not hot. We're breeding a different
type of horse.
I mean, a different type of people. A whole heap of stuff going on there it's going to be interesting going forward. It's going to be interesting.
Because how many of your students and clients have lived a similar or comparable life to the one that you've walked? And how many of them are, let's say, this more modern horse owner that's maybe works a 9-to-5 and they've got a horse, or they've lived semi-rurally, but they've never like been a full-time stock worker, for example, you know?
I don't think there's any. I don't think I've got any students that do.
Wow.
Yeah. I've got one who is just starting out as she's just got a dog not long, so her life is changing in the last year or so, and she's excited about that. So that's pretty cool from, you know, a long time of, I think she was, I lived in the city or so close to the city, and she's loving it. But, you know, so it's interesting listening to her perspective coming in from not knowing anything about being on a farm or a station, working stock and working.
And what did
a dog.
You learn? What did you learn about talking to her and listening to her about her experiences as an outsider walking into, you know, quote unquote, your world. What did you learn? What things bubbled up in your brain as you listened to her?
I was excited that she was actually, you know, taking that step, because often you keep farming out of your vocabulary. You know, it's got a, it can have a negative connotation because,
right.
Yeah, you, but we do it because we love animals, livestock, and we want to keep them healthy and well. So that's something that's really, it's really hard to put out there. But this lady, she's just loving it. And that was exciting, hearing a townie, a city dweller coming out and taking on this life and getting a dog and got a pup and training them and
figuring it out.
Pardon?
Figuring it out.
Figuring it out, yeah.
Yeah, and she's got you and as a mentor. Patience. Yeah.
And patience is huge.
Okay. Oh, patience is a hot button topic for me lately, because I've spent a lot of time with some of my clients. Clients is a hard word. They're human beings that I love and that look to me for help. But patience has surfaced as a hot button topic, and it's deeply, deeply unfashionable to be patient, especially around horses. Have you noticed a trend there as well?
Yeah. Yep, oh, quick fixes, and quick fixes is what a lot of people want. And I said there are no quick fixes with horses, and you can't know anything.
You would know, you would know, because you're coming from this almost Dickensian, like 19th century sort of experience of like growing up on stations in New Zealand and working, you know, stock at the crack of dawn from horseback. I mean, this wasn't like a dude ranch that you did on a summer holiday. This was like actually your life. This wasn't a Disney film. This was how you have authentically grown up. And you're here saying that there are no quick fixes in horsemanship.
No quick fixes.
None at all. Not even like a quick fix.
No.
No.
None.
None.
Yeah, everything from getting the feed right to picking out a foot takes time. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, this is what needs to be said again and again and again and again. And as business people now, trying to make a living, trying to encourage people to be with horses and return to these correct truths, these deep universal truths that are the same across all disciplines, whether it's dressage, whether it's reining, whether it's trail riding, patience, no quick fixes. And yet we live in this late stage capitalism hellscape where everyone wants a quick fix and has been trained at every level from their early experiences right through to what they saw on Facebook that morning to want a quick fix and expect that. And there's this disillusionment that occurs in our students when they discover that, oh, there are no quick fixes. And it's sort of like, oh, wait, you and I, we're like the party poopers constantly popping people's patience bubbles. How, I mean, asking for a friend, I'm not trying to like steal processes from you with your students, but how do you work with people to get them to fall in love with the long format, patient exploration of building little details with horses? I mean, you're in love with it. I'm in love with it. But how do we get other people to fall in love with that?
Oh, God, that's a tricky one. I don't know, because everyone's so different. And, and often they want the quick way to get comfortable and safe with their horse. And that, I mean, that's a hard thing, because, you know, confidence takes time, and it's sad watching people struggle with that, being having to take time, and they want it now, like when they're fearful. You know a lot of people have lost, and I bet you've found it, that a lot of people, like a lot of women, they lose their confidence and they've had no accident. They don't even know why they've lost their confidence.
Where did it go?
Yeah. But Dr. Deb Bennett said in one clinic I was at with her, she said, it's a hormone. It's a fact. It's proven is the courage hormone. It leaves. And you never know if it's going to go or not. And, you know, so it hasn't gone from me yet. And I touch wood, hope it never does. But it's, yeah. And some people have never had an accident. So actually watching them take the time it takes to build that courage when they need it and they want it right now to be safe with their horse, that's hard. And I don't know. I just got to, because I haven't got fear. Unless you put me in the sea, that would be a different story.
In the sea, in the ocean.
Yeah. No, that would be a different story.
I'm
a land lover.
You're a land lover. You're a foot on the ground, salt of the earth kind of horseman. Yeah. Yeah. No, I would rather be, I mean, this sounds horrible to say, I'd rather be in a plane crash than like a sinking ship, frankly.
Me too. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay. Good. We share that. Okay. My skull just exploded because you said two things which blew my mind. Firstly, you mentioned Dr. Deb Bennett, and I have like a 10-year-old schoolgirl's like schoolyard crush on Dr. Deb Bennett. I've got a big like corner of my heart dedicated to her work. She's incredible in my opinion. And you also said that she said to you that courage is hormonal. And there comes a point when it leaves women.
Yeah. Mm.
Why are we not talking about this? And what to do then? Like, what if, Lindley, your like quote unquote courage hormone has already left, but because you've been so disciplined and patient and persistent, you've got this sort of like enmeshed structure of skill that makes up for like hormonal courage. Right? It's like technical now for you rather than like hormonal or physiological. You've just got a skill set that you can rely on whether or not the feeling is there.
Yeah. I think that's interesting because when you're confident in what you're doing and you're at home, you know, coming home, like, you know, your homecoming.
Yeah, I'm right.
Coming home. When I'm in the saddle, I'm home. When I'm with a horse, I'm home. Mm-hmm. I, you know, like talking with you and Georgia and Elizabeth, you know, you guys are artists on that level, and it's fascinating listening to you. And I see you guys and are inspired by you.
Mm.
But with a horse, I feel elegant. I'm short. I have been told that I can't ride because I am the wrong shape, and I just laugh. And because I feel 6 foot tall, well, no, not quite 6 foot tall, but 5 foot, 10 and a half tall. And, you know, I've got long legs and everything when I'm with a horse. But, you know, if I'm not with a horse, I'm not.
You feel like a dodo. Yeah. Wow.
Not much over 5 foot.
Yeah. Well, that inspiration slices both ways. We're hugely inspired by you as well. And I say that as a person who also has a complex relationship with receiving compliments. And I have a feeling that that's true for you as well. Because you're just too busy, like, doing it. You don't need to sit around and hear people telling you about what you do. You don't need that. And I think that's what true confidence is, that your confidence is not up for anyone's debate. What you have and what you can do with the horse belongs to you and only you. And if someone says to you, oh, I love what you're doing and you inspire me, you nod your head and go, yeah, thanks. But that's not going to alter me at any level. And I think that's so important we put that on the table, because a lot of people put conditions on their confidence that they, oh, well, I'll be confident when the horse gives me what I want. I'll be confident when I feel like I can do this technique. I'll be confident when you as coach tells me unequivocally that I'm no longer ruining my horse, then I'll be confident. It's like, no, you need to be confident before you have the skill, before the horse gives compliance. You have to be confident first. Is that true for you as well?
Yep, totally. Yep.
That's so hard to do. Almost.
So hard to do.
Like it might be easier to go to the moon.
It might be, but that's probably the fun of it.
Right.
Yeah, while you're dealing with people, actually, it's a puzzle. And, yeah. I tell you, on the compliments things, you know, I had trouble taking compliments because, you know, they didn't mean anything. But the horse, when I get little, I have these little heart attacks, and now they're not, but first of all, I thought they were, and they're little sparkly hearts start dancing all out of me, and the bangs that go on in your heart, that is a compliment. And that can be the tiniest little thing, like the person leading her horse with connection, that sends my heart into, that's a compliment. Mm. That's when the horse and the person do these tiny little things together that I see as breakthroughs as well. That's, yeah, they give me heart attacks. I call them that little sparkly. I don't know what they are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're weird. Yeah.
Yeah. That's and as coaches in a clinic environment, it's really hard to keep your shit together when you see people getting those little like moments of beauty with their horses. We all get really, really excited. And sometimes I have to clutch my pearls and sit down and have a drink of water and say, I'm sorry, you're just really, really excited. I'll tell you a story, Lindley. One of my clinics, I remember, and I'm vastly less experienced than you are, but you know, I'm still giving it a good go, good old Australian have a go attitude. That's my attitude.
Yeah, so you are.
I'm out there at, well, yeah, we'll see. But I was at a clinic once and someone was there with a horse who had and you'll know what I mean by this, they had a box of frogs energy. The horse's energy was like trying to contain a box of frogs or herding cats. It was just like the horse was everywhere. Very sweet horse, just exceptionally green and just kind of everywhere and all over the place. And the handler was a really nice person, really, really good to their horse, but kind of a little bit all over the place too. There's a lot of pushing and pulling on each other. And that's not my point of view. And so, you know, they came, I think, with the intention of doing all these other things. They wanted to perfect their 20-meter circles or they wanted to work on soft feel. And I'm like, nah, like we're just going to like bring it down to something really, really simple. And I have this very specific memory. Somewhere during like hour 5 of the clinic, I literally turn and I see this totally new picture. I see owner standing quiet with horse at the end of a slack lead rope, standing quiet next to them, not shut down, not disassociated. They were just standing quiet, observing the world. And I turned around and I pointed at them and I said, yes, exactly. And they looked at me and went, what? And they're like, but I'm not doing anything. I'm like, exactly.
Exactly. You know,
exactly. Because you had found this like total stillness. And I think they remain confused about that moment to this day. But like everyone's successes looks different. Like, and you've got to get that stillness first. You can't work stock unless you're still first, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
From a horse. You can't get a horse to focus on something difficult before you've got that clarity and that stillness and that relationship first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. And, do you have stories like that from clinics?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you what I do. Well, not anymore. I don't even have a team of dogs. My last of my A team passed away not that long ago. And I'm not at home often enough to have a dog. It's not fair. But I practiced moving sheep with intent and moving cattle with intent. You know, when you're on a rough place and they've got to go up and down and really steep stuff to get to the gate. And when there's a place where they always, because we had the closest thing to fallow deer as sheep, we had Perindales, so you know, they're like deer, they would always go. They're great at finding holes in fences and finding tricky, buggering off places. I would, because my team of dogs be working somewhere, I used intent to put them in the track through, to go through the gate. I love practicing that. And if I had to talk to a dog, like say, hey sit down, Shaz, or something, and took my intent off the sheep, I'd lose them. You know, they're there. But so that, the power of intent is huge. What you just said, something you just said brought that back to me. And, yeah, it was a game I used to play.
Are you telling me that you've got this repeatable esoteric skill set where clear across space and time you can direct animals across space and time with intent? Is that what you're saying? It's something like this? You're
something able to like say. Maybe. So wow. If I actually had the brave guts to actually say Yes.
This is a safe place for wacky ideas. I don't think that's wacky. I think what you're describing is probably the original language. Before we had spoken word, there was this shared feeling across space. We all talk about it. We all talk about it in our own ways. Yeah. But it's the original language. I mean, it can be really, really spooky sometimes, especially if you're living closely with the animals, and which you always have.
Yeah.
But I'm a townie, right? And I'm walking into deeper and deeper cohabitation and relationships with horses. A couple of weeks ago, I decided to give my ex-dressage horse Sereno an evening meal just to keep the weight on him through winter. I hadn't done it before. I hadn't had a conditioning history with him of feeding him at that time. Typically at that time of night, they're on the other side of the farm eating from one of the hay piles. And I was randomly said, okay, it was about 10 p.m. I was like, I'll go out and give him a meal. Fully expecting I'd have to go halter him and bring him in. Fuck me, Lindley. I walked outside my house. He was right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I kind of looked at him and he looked at me with those beautiful black eyes and just said, yes, Lockie. Like he was Yoda or something. And then in a trance, I just sort of floated to the fence and opened the fence. And he just walked through it as if it was the most obvious thing in the world and stood at his feeding spot like he already knew. And I'm there scratching my head going, okay, well, this is something. And like the other night when we were on our business call and I was talking about my horse Sani and his diagnosis, he was standing underneath the window of my office here the whole time.
Being there time. With you.
It's you've got probably many more stories about this than I do. Is there one that bubbles to the surface that you'd like to try and share with us?
One.
Well, you can pick several.
I got lots. Okay, so I used to ride my mare Laurel everywhere with nothing on, no halter, no saddle, not a string. I didn't ride with a string around her neck, and mustering. She would follow me around. The gates could be open all the way home, and she'd never go. She'd never leave.
Let me just clarify that. You had a mare that you could ride completely tackless and work stock from her completely tackless.
Yep. And jump cross country fences. And
okay.
Yep.
That's a flex. Love it for you. Love that for you, Lindley. Well done. Yeah. Keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was, I didn't think anything of it because it was normal. I was I was and I still am really naive when it comes to things, and that's just that. I thought it was normal. Well, I actually did try to put a bridle on her, and I was riding her out with the bridle, and halfway out, I felt sorry for her, so took it off and carried it home. And so therefore, and she started saying, no, I don't want a halter on, that's rude, so I didn't put one on. And
I remember
doubling, she used to step under me, like I had a head injury, and I fractured my neck when I was young, and I still had a whole heap of things going. But she would step under me, and she would, when we're walking along side by side, she would stop and lean into me or catch me all the time. And I remember one day in the bush, we were galloping in the bush with a friend behind me, and she had a big thoroughbred youngster, and I think it was her first gallop in the bush, and she had a halter on, she was riding in a halter hackamore, and she screamed at me that she hoped that I could stop because she couldn't, and then she did say, my horse, she was a warm blood that I bred, she did a beautiful sliding stop, and it was just round and everything, and this lady said to me years later, you know, you could never get collection with Laurel because you never rode her with anything on her head. And I thought, holy shit, I had collection then because that was natural. Like she sat and said, stop. And I didn't have to do anything. I might pick her mane up a little bit and she would go, oh shit, it's an emergency stop. So she would just sit down and the working cattle, that one. I had to bring a cow home. I was telling someone the other day about it. bringing one heifer, dry heifer, out through the bush, and I'd take her through, I don't know, probably four mobs of cows and gates, and keep my dogs quiet behind me, and my horse took her all the way home. This heifer fought us the whole way, and it was just the most fun. On steep stuff, all I could do was hold on because Laurel took her home, and it was just like, yeah, power of intent. I want that beast at home, quite a way away, and she took it there and took it through cows and calves, and, yeah, the power of intent and the power of being one with your horse, unity, that is...
It's everything. It's just the shit. It's the shit. Like when you get a taste of that, it's like I'm about ready to sell my whole life down the river to live this existence. Like I will eat ramen noodles forevermore if I can have only this. It is an addiction.
When it's you experience,
yeah, I think there's something to be said for the 10,000 or more years of the horse-human partnership, and I think it would be such a shame if during this current tide of change, moving away from problematic training practices, to say that, well, all training of the past was rubbish. I think that's rubbish. I think it's only very, very recent. It's in the last 50 to 100 years only we've seen this resurgence of training trash sort of come to the surface. I think 10,000 years of the horse-human partnership has been forged by many, many, many generations of horse people doing stuff that you are sitting here telling me you've been doing all your life, having this kind of relationship with horses.
Yeah, I suppose I have.
You have. You have. Yeah. I used to work for a lady who told me some similar stories. She was doing, had all her life with horses and doing, you know, backcountry trekking. In southern Spain, and she had this one horse she told me about whom no one else could ride him. He was sour if anyone else did anything with him, but he was like a kitten in her lap with her, and she couldn't attach the girth on him in a way that it contacted his sternum. So the girth, you always had to be able to slide a whole fist under the girth. Otherwise he bucked you off. So she was riding in the mountains with a completely flapping girth, you know, like thank God she had a breastplate. But she told me a story about one of her clients one year had a problem, fell or something, and she had to ride the client's horse. So her horse, who was the guide horse, led the rest of the trek by himself out in front. She just threw the reins over his neck and he was like, okay, mum. And I know exactly what to do and where we're going. And she rode the client's horse while the client got, you know, shipped back to town. And out they were in the back country, and her horse led the whole trek at all paces, walk, trot, and canter, all from a voice cue. And some people would go, oh my God, that sounds like how is that possible? But you and I both know that though that's hard work to achieve, it's actually incredibly normal when you do achieve it.
It is incredibly normal. Mm. Yeah, you don't think anything of it.
And that if you're working with a horse and you're questioning whether you've got that, it means you don't have that yet. Mm. So you breed most of your horses now, is that right? Rather than buy?
Well, I used to. Now I've started again because I'm working on riding from now when I'm 98, still doing the same thing. So I decided I was going to breed my own again, so I didn't have other people's shit to fix when I'm 98 years old.
I mean,
you know, that's a wee while away, but if I don't do it now, I'll be doing it later and it won't be as easy. So keep it up.
It's also dangerous. It's also dangerous when you're buying horses from people that these horses have a bee in their bonnet over their prior treatment and experiences, that we can really, really do a lot to rehabilitate them, but a lot of these horses retain those little problems forevermore. And the only way to know for sure, 100% comprehensively, what is in and with that horse's heart is by breeding them yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever managed to succeed to take a purchased horse from a shitty background and bring them to that place of complete and utter trusting oneness? Have you ever managed to get horses to that place? You have.
Yeah. Yeah. So my little red mare, Holly, so she, my grandkids are riding her. So she's my best trained horse. She's the highest skilled horse that I've got at this point, and my grandkids are riding her. She had was fearful, very fearful when I got her, like for getting on. She'd just run. She was terrified. And so the first ride, and I was told she wouldn't handle being out, going out around the farm. It's like, well, you know, that's all I've got. I mean, I know the people, knew the people. And teaching her that it was okay, that I was not going to hurt her, I'd always get on a bank. Even though she was only 14.2, I'd always get on a bank to get on her. I would never put weight, you know, hang on a saddle or anything like that. Because the saddle slipped, and I think there was a whole heap of disasters when she's amazing. You know, she can have 6 months out. Like, she got concussed, so she had 18 months off. And then she came back in. I get on both sides equally. But when I start the very first ride, I get on the so-called normal side.
Left.
What's that? The left side.
Yep.
And I give her a bicky on the right-hand side. And she stays happy as, you know, it took her a long time for her to learn to eat a bicky, but or a carrot or anything. And always on the right-hand side when I go on. So it was a real reward. She could just stop and wait for that. And now she will put that bicky, whether it's a carrot or a bicky, and she'll just hold it in her mouth on her tongue and just let it dissolve. And it's like, mate.
How did you figure that out?
Yeah. And she just loves it. It is a real reward. That's a real, she knows. She just savors that and just can see her eyes. So that was huge for her to come from. She's a firecracker, but she can teach people who are frightened to ride as well. And even if they're too scared to ride their own horse, she will take them. And so
she knows what fear is.
She knows what fear is.
And she's been rehabilitated through that. And I've seen horses also extend to others.
Yeah.
The very thing that they've had to pass through to get to where they are. They're empathic superheroes in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool. Really cool watching a horse come through.
Mm.
And, you know, when you've got a horse like Allure, she's a six-year-old kid. If you think of a little six-year-old girl that's brought up on the wrong side of the tracks, and, you know, like this, the hungry kids, well, this little horse was hungry for the first year or so of her life. She was removed. I don't know what the word is, but she was picked up and taken off the property. And two men picked her up and as a yearling, picked her up and put her on the float. These two men couldn't pick up my six-month foal and put them on the float because they're not going to be as big as her. But yeah, so she was coming out fighting. When I got her, I would have got her probably as she might have been six. So she was fat when I got her, and, you know, the lady who had taken her on to look after her had, you know, really looked after her.
More with Lindley Bolt in just a moment, but first, let's take a break. Speaking of taking a break, when was the last time you took one? It's really important with our horses that we learn when to hold them, when to fold them, when to walk away, and when to run. And taking a moment for yourself to take a deeper dive into your learning, taking a moment for yourself to experiment or gain mentorship or gain support should become a primary pillar in your horsemanship. So if you're not creating time for learning, you might be creating an intense situation which goes in the wrong direction for you and for your horse. I have so many different options for people that helps you to take a moment for yourself. But probably the biggest one I have on offer is retreats. You can actually sign up for a retreat with me. I have a couple of prerequisites just to make sure that a retreat here at my farm in Spain is the right retreat for you. But after those prerequisites are met, you can actually come to my farm here in beautiful Galicia in Spain during the summer, which is beautiful and mild and not too hot and green and sunny. And you can experience emotional horsemanship for yourself with my horses under my care. If you'd like to explore retreats with me, you can go to emotionalhorsemanship.com and click on the retreats page. There, you can jump on a wait list or make an application to get more information. I'm hoping to see you here. And with that, let us hear more from my friend Lindley about her incredible life with horses.
You're not a tech person.
I'm not a tech person. I'm not. I do my best. I don't even know where that came from. I'll blame Elon Musk. That's what we'll do. So just summarize for us the story of Alua. You're bringing the saddle out of the trailer and
So she's tied to my high line, and bringing my saddle, which was 15 meters away, out of my tack room, which is my horse trailer. She would lunge at me, and she'd never seen my saddle before. So if anybody had seen that, they would say, "Oh, your saddle has hurt her." She didn't like your saddle. She'd never seen it. She was really aggressive, and she's really aggressive, like brushing her. Hmm. She just wanted to attack when you brushed her or put a cover on. I put a light cover on, so she didn't like covers, but to actually say, "It's okay, I can put a cover on you and, you know, a rug, and it's just light, and you just got to carry it, and I can take it off." So she knew that it was not going to be stuck there forever, you know, because when you put something on a horse, I've gone off track again, when you put something off on a horse, they don't know that it's never going to come off.
Right. Right. So when we do. They don't.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They don't. They don't know that when we strap that saddle to their back for the first time, that is ever coming off. So when I put a saddle on, I take it off straight away.
Mm.
Put it on again, you know. When I get on a young horse for the first time, I get on and I get off straight away.
Mm.
And I might do that for months because I don't ride a horse till they're six. So I take a long time. But so Alua, it took a long time to show her slowly. You know, I just put the saddle out and put it on a stand out there so she could sniff it or anything, and it never went near her. And
she was that angry at the symbol of a saddle. Yep. And yep. You hadn't done anything with her to it. She hasn't seen that particular saddle. She just knew what the symbol was.
Yeah.
And that was enough for her to say, "Never again."
Yep. And so I just took months to get that until even putting it on, she'd want to bite you. And I always saddle from the right-hand side.
Mm.
And that'll be from starting horses, probably, if people will ask me, I always start, then I've got that side already sorted and I can go around and do it up on the left-hand side. So, and most of us don't work our horses from the right-hand side.
Right side.
Yeah, but I'm pretty ambidextrous. And I often will halter a young horse for the first time on the right-hand side.
Why is that?
Then I just sort of found that they get that is – that is comes easy. They get used to you being on that side first because you're still going to do most stuff on the left-hand side.
Ah, I see. So it's like preemptive prevention of them becoming too one-sided. It's a big problem. A lot of horses won't lunge to one side. Even if they've never had a bad experience there, they'll only prefer giving you one side to the other. Okay. And what you said about putting it on and taking it off again, that's music to my ears. At my clinics, when we do the ridden portion in the afternoon, I have everyone bring their horses in naked with the tack on the fence, and I want to see the entire process. And we're literally showing the saddle pad, taking it away, rinse, repeat. And I'll do that dozens of times to make sure the horse is completely confident and comfortable that the pad's going to come on. And then the pad goes on. I say, "Right, take it off again." Saddle goes on. That looked good. Okay, let's do that again, just to be sure. And you'd be amazed. I mean, you wouldn't be amazed, but it is amazing how many horses, particularly horses who are in regular work,
yeah,
really actually struggle with the concept of saddling, even when you, well, especially when you start actually asking them how they feel about it rather than just getting on with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
My horse, Sorenyo, he's pretty, for his age, he's pretty high mileage, at least within an arena. He hasn't had miles like on the land or miles on trail, but in an arena, he's pretty high mileage, too high mileage, in fact, because he's already developed arthritis by 10. But once I started peeling back the layers with him, I could saddle him when he was totally stoic, but, you know, head's in the air, underside and neck's looking a bit thick, and he would just have this faraway look in his eye like he was getting an injection or something, just kind of turning his eyes away from it. But then when I started peeling back the layers and actually showing him the tack, and with my intention, as you so rightly put it, saying, dude, how do you actually feel about all this?
Yeah.
You know what was there. It was ears back and a head shake. And it was like, oh my God, I need to really slow this down and actually refine this. Same at the mounting block. Stand on the mounting block. How do you actually feel about all this? Backing up. Don't get on me.
Yeah.
It's like, interesting. Yeah. The grace of horses to perform in spite of all of those misgivings.
Oh God, yeah. What they do for us is amazing.
It's out of this world.
Out of this world. Yeah. That mounting block's huge. It's huge. Huge. It's a huge thing.
It's so big.
Yeah.
I have a friend who she's got her horses to the point where they can perform miracles at the mounting block. Like she's got these great Liberty videos for social media where one of her geldings canters across the arena, does a half, like a half of a pirouette, and then backs up, reverses, and picks her up at the mounting block. But she really struggles to ride him.
Yeah.
So for him, he's happy for her to be on, but then to do something while she's on is a totally different subject for him. Have you found that some horses are quite compartmentalized in their training, and each thing you teach them is like you have to start from the beginning again? Have you ever experienced that?
Yeah. So my horse that's just who has been retired this winter, just gone from cancer, he had huge problems with the mounting block. I could get on him anywhere but the mounting block. It was he would park, I started him over again, but he still had whatever. He's not a real horse. He just lives in a horse's body. He's a real character. But he would park at the mounting block, and he wouldn't lunge to the – he didn't like lunging to the right. Mm. But when he was at Liberty at the mounting block, he always went to the right. And I found that interesting. But he would come to the mounting block, and he would turn his head away. It might be 45 minutes in, he'd just have his head turned away. And when he finally brought his head back, then I knew I was allowed on. He was okay with it. And that was one lesson I had. He gave me, like, he parked beautiful. And if anyone had seen it, they'd thinking, well, why wouldn't you get on? But I just had, no, not yet. This isn't right. And I spent 45 minutes waiting for him, with no pressure, and when you're ready, and he could leave at any point in time and come back, and he did, and he'd just come back in, and he knew I was on the mounting block. He's not dumb. He knows what a mounting block is, but he didn't want to be there. And when he finally said yes, it was heaven, because he'd walk 20 metres, happy as, and then turn around and say, get off. no, get off. And I didn't back, but you know, he told me I had to get off, and I asked him to go forward a few times and come through that. No, come on, let's go. And he goes, no, off you get, ears forward.
That's all I'm giving you today.
Yeah. And the mounting block was huge. But when he actually gave consent, I'm okay with this.
It was good.
It was good. Yeah. And that was huge learning for me.
You had been working on that for a long time, and then that one breakthrough session, it was a 45-minute long conversation about the same thing.
Yep. And I said nothing. I just waited for him. I just waited, being present and just standing on the mounting block waiting for him. I didn't leave that mounting block. And I did, to have a pee just down beside it.
You and I both know that there are a lot of horse owners who just wouldn't have the patience to work that through for such a period of time, or would believe at some level that they're forcing the subject if they waited that patiently, or would not believe that the horse was capable of needing 45 minutes to think through the thing before the horse was like, you know what, I'm going to give this a go. I'm going to try for you. I'm going to try that for you because I can see that it's important to you. And 45 minutes has passed and I'm still alive and I haven't been harmed and I haven't been confused. And so I'm going to give you a go. A lot of people are really just on this side of the fence of a breakthrough. And the thing that will get them through it, in my opinion, is patience, staying the path. You just reminded me of again the clinic I did in Wyoming when Kim Kizia Sherrod was there. She's running a bodywork school out of Wyoming as well. She's amazing. She was there with her horse, who I believe his name was Charger. I could be wrong about that, but Charger was 19 and had never been properly started. So 19, used all his life from age 2 or 3, but behaved like a green horse when you actually asked his opinion about everything. You know the type. And his body caught a horse, ranch horse. His body told the story of years of use with inappropriate muscle chains and years of discomfort under saddle. And so we presented the mounting block to him. And on the first day, she could kind of get on with it. She got on. And I actually had to step over and hold the horse for her to get off because he was fixing to have a wreck. He was fixing to have a wreck. So I was like, okay, we're going to get off. We're going to. And she de-escalated him on day one. She managed to get back on, but he basically shut down on day one. So we finished the clinic for him. And on the day two, he said, "You ain't getting on me."
Yep.
And Kim Kizia Sherrod was described by my clinic host in Wyoming as, "Oh, she's our hippie friend," they said. And so she was the body worker. She was everyone's body worker, and she did energy work with ranch horses in Wyoming. Kind of amazing. She's really, really wonderful. You would love her. You would love her. And she worked with Charger at the mounting block like it was a body work session. She quietly would ask him to reposition. And when he positioned, she'd just pet him in the eyes and tell him it's all right. It's all okay. And then she would go to the stirrup and he'd step away and she'd repeat the process. She was there for 1 hour and 5 minutes. And I stepped back and I said, "Kim is teaching a masterclass in patience now. She's now the teacher of this clinic. Yeah. I'm just the idiot sidekick. Everyone watch what she's doing." She was there for 1 hour and then we turned around and she was on and Charger was at peace, truly at peace. And then we spent the rest of the clinic working on his walk and trot transitions, but I had to pony Charger off my horse. So we were using this happier, well-developed ranch horse as a transfer for Charger to get, you know, confident transitions. It was beautiful. And you just reminded me of just that. So to hear that you've had very similar experiences for me is really, really validating that I'm not completely off track here, you know?
No. It's huge. I have 5-day clinics. There's one lady, well, two people actually, man and a lady, both have had, if someone else comes and they say, "Oh, the mounting block," and these people say, "Mounting block, you got nothing on the mounting block, 5 days at the mounting block." And they both had 5 days twice. The second time they got to do more stuff, but the first time the mounting block was a big thing. They'd do the groundwork and then they'd spend the next person's lesson, they were at the mounting block, and you know, they could stay at the mounting block all day, just taking the time it took. So the mounting block's pretty good for those two people because they've spent days and that, you know, one of them, they'd look at you while you're busy teaching another lesson. You go, no, that was that good enough, was it? And they go, "Oh, no."
Yeah, it does take that long sometimes, especially if horses have had bad experiences initially.
Yeah.
It takes that long for horses to discover that they're safe, that to discover a new thought process around it. They just really think in much, much longer forms than us. And you kind of don't know that until you've experienced that and felt the other side of it.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's an amazing process. And for the horse to say, for the person to have the patience to listen, when you can listen to the horse and you say to the horse, you know, like a lure, I hear you. I know you've got stuff to say. Let it out. So she did. She says, well, if you want to listen, I've got all this to say. I say, oh, no, one bit at a time. I can't hear that.
Yeah, as soon as you ask them, they say, oh, you want to hear? And then they roll out their list.
They like, roll
number
it.
One, number one, what the actual fuck? Number two, what does this all mean? Number three, you smell funny. Number four, I can smell you eat meat. Number five, you know, and they just go down there.
Yeah.
Number six, don't bloody touch me. Number 87, what the hell is that? You know, and they just start sharing all these things.
Yeah.
And I've had clients come to me and say, Lockie, what exactly is happening to my horse? Yeah. I said, this is part of the process. As the horse is having a meltdown, I said, this is part of the process. This is part of the process. And there is something better on the other side of that.
Yeah. It's almost like a little kid having a tantrum in a supermarket.
Right. And they need to, because often these horses have had these egregious things happen to them and they've never expressed it, and they've got these things they have to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like us.
And finally you've given them the voice, so they let it out. Are you sure you want to hear? Yeah, we can. And they go,
I don't think you can handle what exactly I have to say.
Yeah. I was like, well, try me.
Everyone wants a connected horse that communicates with them. Everyone wants that until they have a connected horse that communicates with them. And they say, but I'm not hearing what I wanted to hear. It's like, well, you got what you asked for. So here we are. The next piece of that is accountability and patience and technique, coaching.
Yep. And observation is key. Observation is key to the horse. I work on observation. Like, that's a skill I want people to actually grow, because it's quite lost in so many ways. I say, I want you to hone in your observation skills, you know, your habits. What are your habits? How do you walk? How do you feel the dirt? How do you feel the arena under your feet? And then when you start feeling every raindrop that falls on the roof,
you're getting close to the horse's world. Yeah.
Yeah. And I say it is really intense, but observe. You've got to observe, because as soon as you observe things, the horse knows they're safe. You can't be safe to the horse if you can't see. And seeing with all your senses, not just your eyes, all your senses. And there's more than five.
That just landed with me in a really powerful way.
Yeah. So when I get a horse like Holly, my little red horse that the grandkids are riding, when I get a horse and it might take 6 months for them to see the deer, the wild deer before me, as soon as they see that deer before me, I know I'm safe, because now they're awake. You know, when you've had that horse, that's not that they've been shut down, but they're just living to get by. When they wake up, when they're free to be awake and see stuff, you know, like Laurel, the one that I rode with nothing, I learned to sit a horse bareback because she saw things 2 Ks away. She saw everything a long way away. So when finally it was right up close, she'd get a fright. And it was a big leap. And I said, well, you saw that a couple of Ks away. She said, but it wasn't here. And so I went. Yeah. So that was quite interesting. Yeah. Character building. But when a horse sees deer first, I know I'm safe. When people say, I don't want my horse to get frights, I want my horse to see everything. When your horse, what do you do when your horse is scared of that log? Yeah, but I'm not scared of the log. But what do you do if your horse is scared of the log? I says, yeah, they might see a shadow or anything there, but I'm not scared of the log. So if I'm not scared of the log, my horse will have confidence in me that I've got their back. So they won't be scared of the log.
It's so important. I'm reminded of a very specific memory myself of a ex-Grand Prix jumping horse that I spent a lot of time with prior to owning my own horses. And he was quintessential shutdown, like just dead to the world, dead to the world. Like you could have, if you wanted to, beated him to a pulp with every leverage device you wanted to in an arena, and he would have groaned and taken a step forwards. Like he just gave you nothing in the arena, just stood there like a stone. He was like, I have given enough. He was only 15.
Yeah.
Won competitions. He hated it. Bought for big money out of Holland. Hated it. But if you took him to the forest, he would just sort of sigh and stretch out, and he'd say, okay, I can do that. I can do that. And so I spent a lot of time with this horse. His name was Salvador, and he's still alive. He's in his 20s now, but spent a lot of time with him, and he was kind of quote-unquote bomb-proof, but because he was so shut down, it was almost like he didn't care about the world anymore. And I remember after about 6 months of quiet, long-form hacking with him, we were riding out in the spring, and he saw a tractor and went, holy fuck, what the hell is that? And he looked at the tractor and he went, oh my God. And I went, Salvador, hello. Welcome back to the world. You care whether you live or die now. Fantastic. Yeah. And instead of seeing that as a problem, instead of saying, how do I help my ex-Grand Prix jumping horse not have a phobia about tractors? That was never my question. It was like, I'm so glad that you now care enough about your person, about your body, to show me what frightens you. Thank you for showing me that.
Yeah.
You know?
It's cool. And we get those horses that you've got to there's one horse I had to he was like a snuffleupagus. He'll just slobber you and suck your hand up in his mouth. And so I first of all, I'm not going to give you a treat. I don't do clicker training. If I want to give a horse a treat, I'll walk across the arena to give them a treat. I don't care. They don't need to do anything for one. But with him, I was like, you know, he was a biter. He was a friggin' funny. And he's the only horse I've ever had that has tried to take me out by fighting like a giraffe, you know, with swinging his head and as well. and so he was really funny. But I did. That wasn't actually particularly funny at the time. But he, I wasn't going to give him bickies or anything, treats. But then I says, no, I'm going to. But you've actually got to participate in your life before you get one. He wanted them so bad. And I says, you can have them, but you've got to participate in your life first. And that was fascinating because he would say you could ride him out. He'd just toddle along really slow. You could hardly get him to move. And then he would, but if you rode with spurs and carried a whip, he says, okay, you don't need anything like that. You never needed to touch him with anything. But if you didn't take one of those, he'd go, you got nothing. And it's like, well, I'm not using spurs. When you got to carry them just so he will move, that was interesting.
So many horses are that way.
Mm-hmm. And so I ride in a hackamore. And so I used my McCarty and I flapped my leg and he goes, oh, shit, where'd that come from? Never had a problem after that. He'd go, he was keen to go. All of a sudden he goes, oh, you've actually got something out of the box and you're interesting. And he went. He was a character. He was like, it was a quarter horse and he moved. Like he just plodded along and then he cantered and it was amazing. Cantered him on the lunge. It was amazing. It was, oh my God, drop dead gorgeous. I'd never seen a canter like it. And I went, oh my God, that's amazing. And he stopped and he looked at me and I went, oh my God, that was amazing. And he goes, I was coming in to kill you. And I says, but Jesus, that was beautiful.
So beautiful.
And he was like, you're praising me for, He was really confused. I was praising him for doing something and he was ready to attack. He was trying to intimidate me then, and it was just like outstanding. I can still see it. It's, you know, those moments that are there forever.
I was teaching a lesson online to one of my long-term clients. This is probably about 18 months ago. And she was struggling with walk-trot transitions with her gelding, who had been kind of overfaced a little bit too young. So he's a bit sour and a bit sticky, and we're working through that. And she asked for a trot transition and he gave it, but he flipped her the bird as he gave it and kind of big-rooted a little bit. And I said, good, now give him a treat. And my client said, what? I said, stop right now and give him a treat. She said, what? I said, do you trust me? She said, yes. I said, stop right now and give him a treat. Yeah. So she stopped. She gave him a carrot, and this horse's eyes went wide as saucers. He was like, what? That's not what I expected at all. I was like, exactly. We're here to break the pattern, because he thought that, oh, you're fighting with me over my energy use, so I'll give it to you, but I'll tell you how I think about it as I give it. But what we were actually asking was that he was participating. Show up. Put your cards on the table so that we can talk about these problems and resolve them. But we can't resolve these problems if you don't express them to us, right?
Yeah.
And so that was a turning point for them as a couple, because he was like, okay, I thought that was punishable offense, and it's not. It was a rewardable offense. Okay. And you could actually see all the wheels turning in his head, rethinking all of his perceptions of training, because he realized that our intention was no longer the intention he thought it was. And he actually had to listen to us and really think it through, rather than just give these knee-jerk responses all the time. So I'm happy to hear that out there in New Zealand, you had a very, very similar occurrence with this funny guy.
Yeah like I'll praise I One Horse. She died way too early, but she when I got her, she couldn't canter, not even in the paddock. She was the wrong shape, her whole body unique, everything was just like, people told me to get rid of her because she wasn't my cup of tea. Oh, she was heaven, because she came from not being able to canter, not even in the paddock, to doing back up and coming out on whichever leg, you know, you'd back up and thinking about whatever leg, and she would just come out into that canter and do working pirouettes. And she was a quarter horse, and then she, a pleasure bred quarter horse, she didn't want to be. And then she would, got to the place where she'd, coming back from mustering, she'd jump up a bank and buck, and it was like, woohoo, give her, that was, you know, amazing. And people would say, why would you reward her for that? I says, well, Jesus, that's awesome. She's coming back after 4 hours and she's given a
feeling good enough.
Sheer excitement and joy in life. And that's cool. When they start galloping to you, when you call them, and that, you know, down a long way away, and they race the younger horses and they're neighing and bucking and squealing, and they come in up to say, what are we doing today? Now that, and when they start piaffing, practicing piaff when you're working your dog, and people think, why are you letting them prance when they're, she's a hello, no hands, she's not prancing, she's practicing. And, but it's so clever. Oh, so smart.
Lindley, we're going to start winding it up. I could listen to you share stories for hours, and I have a feeling we're going to have more story times together on my podcast, if you're willing. But I'm going to take you through three little questions/segments to finish up. The first one, I call it "What the Muck." I mean, I don't have any problem swearing, but you know, there's something in the equestrian industry that's a steaming pile of something in the corner that we all as a community can do better by mucking it out. For you, if you had to pick one thing, what would you muck out of the equestrian industry?
Oh, that one thing. Oh, I'd go to the mounting block. I'd go back to the mounting block. And actually have not just acceptance, but actual willing, yes, please, get on, because they're so keen on what we're going to do. And I mean, the mounting block is the horse float as well. But and the mounting block's just a metaphor. Consent
and mucking out a lack of it. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And Lindley, for a word like horsemanship, I think we're lacking in some nautical references as a community. So as much as that goes, and we understand that there's a tide of change occurring across almost every discipline around horses right now, how do you see yourself contributing to those tides of change?
How do I see myself wanting to those tides?
Contributing.
Time. The first word that comes to head is time. Giving time. Giving the horse time, giving the people time, giving the space. Giving space.
Perfect. It's perfect. It's beautiful. That's a perfect answer. And finally, what is home to you with your horses? I mean, horses are your home, but the feeling of home, describe home to us for you.
Oh, it's in here. It's in the soul. It's my soul, totally my soul. And it can be, it's peace. It's sacred space. And it's being with my horse, doesn't matter if I'm riding or just in hand or just seeing a moment. You know, I take hologram horses with me when I'm working with students often, and that I can still feel that space because I'm getting one of those heart things again. So that's that space, that that's home, just being in presence.
Lindley, thank you so much for taking the time this evening to speak with me. This morning. I'm so excited for your future, finding an audience even further afield than the one you already have established for yourself in New Zealand. And it's wonderful, your contribution. You're one of a kind. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Lockie.
All right. You've been listening to the Emotional Horsemanship Podcast. I am your host, Lockie Phillips, and that was my guest, Lindley Bolt. If you'd like to learn more about Lindley, you can check her out by visiting her details in the show notes. And of course, I recommend everyone who listens to this podcast to visit emotionalhorsemanship.com to explore different ways that you can begin learning emotional horsemanship for yourself. Thank you for joining me here today. Don't forget to follow and subscribe this podcast wherever you get your podcasts for new weekly episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.